This is Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
M.S. Swaminathan, an agricultural scientist and an outstanding visionary, renowned for steering the Green Revolution movement, passed away on September 28, 2023. He was 98. Right from preventing the famine of South Asia in the 1960s, to assisting Cambodia to retrieve the traditional rice varieties after the 1970 war, his contributions to global agriculture are humongous. More so, his involvement towards implementation of these solutions on the ground is also highly significant. For instance, he set up demonstration plots to show the proven effective solutions to the farmers. This helped the farmers on ground to know the impact of these scientific measures. This was his way of convincing them to implement the solutions on their own land to enhance productivity and also increase their incomes. He not just spoke to the farmers, but also politicians and global scientists. His interactions with Prime Minister Indira Gandhi for national level policy changes were instrumental for a new radical shift in the agricultural reforms of India. After receiving the first World Prize in 1987, he set up M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation in 1988 to address the modern day problems of the farmers. The foundation since then has worked with various farming communities for sustainable agriculture and other current pressing issues they face today. Hello, I'm Sharda Balasubramanian. In this episode for Snow India's Climate Emergency Podcast, I speak to R. Ram Kumar, an agricultural and development economist from the Tata Institute of Social Sciences. Ram Kumar talks about M.S. Swaminathan, how he championed the Green Revolution movement, among a host of other things. He gives us many stories on the legacy of M.S. Swaminathan as an agricultural scientist. So, thank you so much for giving us your time. And to begin with, I know we are all talking about Mr. Swaminathan's demise and how he set up MSSRF. But going back to Green Revolution and what really happened then that the world doesn't know, if there's something as an agricultural economist that you would like to tell us about what we don't know about Green Revolution, I think it'll be a great thing to start with.
Well, to begin with, Professor M.S. Swaminathan was one of the foremost agricultural scientists of the world, and certainly so in the developing part of the world, but he's widely recognized as one of the foremost agricultural scientists in the world itself. That's because one of the most important turns in agricultural science happened in the second half of the 20th century, and Professor Swaminathan was in the middle of it all, leading the whole process in a country like India, which is very large in terms of population, and a country which a lot of people look forward to for learning and experiences and so on. The turn in the second half of the 20th century essentially was a context where a large number of developing countries like India, for example, had become independent from colonial rule. In countries like India, they had more than a century of stagnating agricultural growth rate, rising population, falling per capita availability of food grains, frequent famines hitting the country. Particularly the Bengal famine of the early 1940s was a rude shock to British policymakers as to what bad policies can do to food security, hunger, and bitter experiences. So by the 1950s, there was this view that that increasing food grain production is a very important necessity of the time. India at that time was producing only a part of its requirements. It was importing close to 3 million tons of food grains in 1950, for which it was spending a bomb as we call it, about 150 crore rupees at that time, which is very large. And it was sucking away very important foreign exchange that India was having at that point of time. And the population was rising, per capita incomes were rising, food consumption was supposed to rise significantly in that period. And there was no way that India could increase its food grain production without making a quantum jump in productivity. Now, for some time, India was able to make use of increase of area to increase production. There were a lot of uncultivated area, fallow land, etc., land which was cultivated only once in, and so on in the colonial period. All of that could be brought back into cultivation in the 1950s, but that had its limits. Once fresh area got saturated, the only way to increase production is to increase productivity. So that is where Swaminathan and others set out to look for specific solutions to increase productivity per unit area, which would allow India to keep its cultivated area constant and yet increase production. That is the most important part of the Green Revolution story. How to increase production without increasing area. In the previous, say, 500 to 10,000 years back, right up to the Neolithic Revolution, if you see, productivity had hardly grown. Most of the increase in production came from increase in area. And where did this area come from? Cutting down forests, cutting down sort of encroaching into fragile lands and so on. That was essentially how agricultural production was sought to be increased in the period prior to the Green Revolution. But here, you could actually now create a solution which is also forest saving, which was not quite recognized at that point of time. Today, you realize that increase in productivity can actually lead to enormous amount of carbon savings also. So that is something that Green Revolution set out to achieve. Swaminathan and others were looking for specific characteristics in rice and wheat, which could be incorporated into Indian land races or varieties and so on. And they found these varieties from Japan, China, and so on in rice and wheat, which were short-stemmed. Short-stemmed is important because if you had long, thin stems, they would break and sort of bend and fall down when heavy breezes are in place. There were varieties which were photoperiod insensitive in the sense that they are not affected by increases in day length and night length. In winter, as you know, in large parts of northern India, the day lengths will shorten, which means that less sunlight is available and flowering of the plant is affected adversely. So can you have a plant which is not affected by changes in day length, which would give you stable productivity in both Kharif season and Rabi season, even when day lengths are different? Then they were looking for varieties which had more resistance to pests and diseases, varieties which were responsive to application of fertilizers and so on. So they succeeded in finding varieties from across the world from where traits, by crossing varieties, traits could be passed on to Indian varieties and authentic Indian varieties could be prepared from such crossings in breeding. That is how one of the most popular, some of the most popular high-yielding varieties of rice and wheat were developed in the 1960s in India's public agricultural research system. As a result, what you see is that in the period of the second half of the 1960s, India could double its wheat production in a short period of 6 to 7 years. That's why it's called a revolution. India doubled its wheat production in about 5 to 6 to 7 years. That essentially meant that over a medium term, if you come to the 1980s or so, India could meet its food grain requirements without importing food grains from the rest of the world. That was one of the most important achievements of Green Revolution. At that point of time, a shortage of food grains was essentially something which was related to political sovereignty as well. For example, what position should India take with regard to the Vietnam War, whether India should devalue its currency or not. All these economic and foreign policy decisions were held hostage to the supply of food aid from the United States under the PL 480 food aid program. And this is one of the, another important reason why India wanted to get rid of the food aid dependence that it had in the 1950s and 1960s. And achieving food grain self-sufficiency also helped India to gain political sovereignty. It could take economic and foreign policy decisions without being held hostage to the interests of countries like United States, which were important suppliers of these food aid. So that is also a very important sort of gain of the Green Revolution. In many crops like rice, when breeding spread into other types like basmati rice, India could begin exporting them to the world. Today, India is one of the leading exporters of basmati rice to the world. That is also something that we are indebted to Professor Swaminathan. So all these are important features of Green Revolution, which made Swaminathan justly famous. And that's precisely the reason why when Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, in his acceptance lecture, he named Professor Swaminathan and said, if Swaminathan had not found the short-stemmed trait in certain varieties and brought them to India, Green Revolution in Asia would not have happened. That is also why when the world's first food prize was instituted in 1987, Swaminathan was selected as the first recipient of that award. India, of course, has awarded him with some of its highest honors, Padma Shri, Padma Bhushan, Padma Vibhushan, and so on. So he is somebody who is an important person in the story of India's journey from a sort of a ship-to-mouth existence, as it was called, to a situation of food grain self-sufficiency and political sovereignty.
So it also brings a question to me, like when Green Revolution was, when it started, and I think Professor Swaminathan was also directly talking to a lot of farmers to educate them or to bring in some literacy, right? So how challenging would that have been in the times when this is a drastic shift, right? When we talk to farmers and convince them to adopt certain practices. So what really happened with respect to his interaction with farmers at that point of time?
You know, one of the important ways in which agricultural science is different from other sciences like physics or chemistry if other sciences are largely about basic research and their application, so basic research and applied research, agricultural science is a lot more also not just about basic research and applied research, it's also a lot about adaptive research. So agricultural research is something that is very closely linked to the field of agricultural extension, which is essentially a program of lab to land and back, of course. So essentially, Swaminathan realized early on that unless a certain amount of credibility was generated for the new agricultural technology, unless farmers had some amount of trust in the technology that it will indeed increase productivity and increase their incomes, no farmer would have actually come forward and done it. If you go to a farmer who has historically had a productivity of 1 ton per hectare in rice or wheat, and you tell him that no, it's possible to have 5 tons per hectare in your crop instead of 1 ton per hectare, a lot of farmers would simply say, are you joking? Are you kidding? And they'll simply push you away. But that's essentially the barrier that Swaminathan had to transcend. So what he did was he traveled across North India, Northwestern India, and so on. And what they did was to establish national demonstration plots in most of these states. So you had demonstration plots in agricultural research institutions, sometimes in the farms of progressive farmers and so on, where the new technology was used, and it was actually demonstrated to the farmer that, look, this is a field where we did this and we got 4 to 5 tons per hectare. And so if farmers come and see it, they would actually be more believing in what the technology could actually achieve. So this national demonstration plots was a very important initiative at that point of time. A large number of plots were established in those states where Green Revolution happened. Farmers could go there, see it, and then learn for themselves as to what is to be done to triple or quadruple their productivity. So that is very, working with farmer was very important in agricultural research at that point of time. And Swaminathan was certainly one of the leaders of this practice from then on. That is something that, unfortunately, we are slightly missing out on in the more recent times when such demonstration plots and their importance is increasingly weakening. And that's something that India has to critically assess in its present policy emphasis. But during the Green Revolution time, this kind of adaptive research where scientists worked with farmers, scientists took their technology to the field, applied them, and farmers would sort of present with them some problems, some constraints. So you take the technology back to the lab, rework it, improve it, and take it back as a new variety. So this kind of constant feedback relationship between the scientific community and the farming community was one of the highlights of the success of Green Revolution in India.
Also, the fact that on one side we have farming community, on the other side we have the policy makers, right? I think I read somewhere that Professor Swaminathan also engaged with in talks with Indira Gandhi and to talk about agricultural changes in agricultural policies and reforms. So how significant was that at that point of time? Because there are so many stakeholders and you need to like talk to all of them, right? So how difficult or easy was it to convince somebody like Indira Gandhi to bring a reform in agricultural policy making? It's something I would like to hear from you.
We know it only from what Professor Swaminathan himself has said and written. There are stories about how he often traveled in a car with Indira Gandhi when she either traveled from her office to a function of in the Agricultural Research Center in Delhi and so on. In those journeys and short meetings, Ms. Gandhi would probably ask Mr. Swaminathan, are you sure that this technology would work? This thrust that we are giving would actually work? So Swaminathan would tell her that, give me X number of years, and I will show you that it can be done. And that kind of confidence that he put out would have certainly influenced Ms. Gandhi and let her give him more amounts of freedom in running the agricultural research establishment. He was also deeply indebted to the agriculture minister at that point of time, Mr. C. Subramaniam, with whom he developed a very good rapport at that point of time, and the agricultural secretary, Mr. Shivraman, at that time. So they were called as the three S's at that time, Mr. Subramaniam, Mr. Shivraman, and Mr. Swaminathan. All three of them, probably they were also from southern part of India, probably that also helped them to strike a good rapport. But nevertheless, what essentially was in display was, I think Professor Swaminathan has said this in some interview, that this is what he would call as the Green Revolution Symphony, a symphony where the knowledge of the agricultural scientist, the political maneuvering skill of the politician, and the entrepreneurial spirit of the farming community, all of them came together to produce the success of the Green Revolution in India. So essentially what he was trying to point out was there was a political establishment there which believed in the scientist, which believed in science, which gave them confidence, invested public money into these institutions. They created agricultural research institutions, they created agricultural universities, they funded research projects, they funded extension activities. So there was enormous amount of public backing up, government backing up of the agricultural research initiatives of scientific community at that point of time. And that could not have happened without a very close interrelationship that existed between and trust that existed between the political establishment, the scientific community, and of course, as we discussed earlier, the farming community. I think the leadership of Mr. C. Subramaniam played a very important role in creating a political constituency for the Green Revolution at that time.
And when we talk about the Green Revolution, also, if you could simply tell me, what were the short-term impacts of it? And also the long-term impacts, has Green Revolution in any way, or is it contributing to any impact in today's scenario?
Green Revolution is a there's a story of continuity in it. At that point of time, in the 1960s, the technologies that were readily available were in rice and wheat. That's something that India immediately decided to use and go forward. There have been downsides to this. For example, because rice and wheat was giving so much productivity, other crops which did not have that kind of productivity or which did not have the emergence of technologies at that time, like for example, millets or for example, pulses, saw a decline in their area, and those areas were substituted with higher yielding rice and wheat. So there was this problem that area under millets, area under pulses, etc., came down during that time. And this has had some nutritional implications because those cereals also provide proteins. The quality of proteins that cereals provide are lower. The quality of proteins provided by pulses and millets are much higher. And that was something that Green Revolution could be faulted for. But that's something that India is currently working on. The establishment is currently working on in terms of trying to increase pulse production to make use of the current global thrust on millet production to increase its area and so on. So there is something happening there because science has now spread into millets, pulses and so on. We have high yielding varieties there as well, and farmers are increasingly getting more and more confident of growing them, just as they were in growing rice and wheat. And all the other problem that is often cited is that of the increasing use of chemicals in agriculture. The use of external chemicals in agriculture is a necessity to increase agricultural productivity. Soil is not inherently rich in nutrients. Indian soils are famous for being poor in organic content, very poor in nitrogen, phosphorus, potash, and so on. And it cannot be simply taken care of by using either cow urine or cow dung or green leaves and so on. You need external application of chemicals, chemical fertilizers in agriculture. But Swaminathan was one of the first in 1967 and 68. Swaminathan was one of the first to actually argue for an evergreen revolution. He said that we should ensure that through scientific and precision farming, we should ensure that overuse of chemicals, overuse of fertilizers, pesticides, etc. should be discouraged, and we should have a proper balanced application of fertilizers and pesticides. This is what now agricultural science calls as integrated nutrient management on the one side and integrated pest management on the other, where the focus is on improving the efficiency of application of chemicals, thereby reducing the need to apply chemicals in the quantities that they used to be applied. That's something that is bearing success in India over the last 20 to 30 years. So Green Revolution is a process. It was earlier only in rice and wheat. It is now spreading into more crops. Earlier, it was only in Punjab, Haryana, and Western Uttar Pradesh. It is now slowly spreading into other states also. It is earlier focused on the application of chemicals. That continues, but the focus is now on increasing the efficiency of use of chemicals in agriculture. So it's a continuity as well.
And apart from India, like I think Professor Swaminathan has also worked, I was reading that during the war in Cambodia, I think when Cambodia lost their rice strain, I think there was some genetic pool that was like already there, and you know, he revived it and he helped it. So could you like tell me, like other than India, like what is his contribution towards global agriculture as such? Like how has he impacted the global agriculture?
The first impact that Swaminathan has had is by demonstrating the possibilities of Green Revolution to the to other parts of the world, starting from India's experience. That's one. But more directly, if you ask me, Swaminathan began a new phase of his career in 1982 when he was appointed the Director General of the International Rice Research Institute in Manila, in Philippines. As the Director General of IRI, Swaminathan was instrumental in ensuring that rice research institutions of global quality are established in large number of countries, including China, Burma, countries of Southeast Asian part of the world, and so on. So a lot of initiatives were taken by Swaminathan to promote national agricultural research systems in many of the countries of Asia and Southeast Asia in particular. That's number one. The second is something that existed even prior to Swaminathan's joining the International Rice Research Institute, which is their International Rice Germplasm Center, or what is called as a gene bank, where large number of native and traditional seed varieties are stored for future use. Now, a lot of people actually have argued very ignorantly and sort of without knowing the science of agriculture, that this is like some kind of a gene robbery and so on. You take away India's varieties and store it in Philippines. That's not a great idea. It's like presenting Indian varieties to foreigners and so on. That's complete nonsense. They don't understand the basics of agricultural science. Essentially, what the International Rice Research Institute set out to do in the 1950s and 60s itself was to collect traditional rice varieties and store them safely for future use. If you leave a traditional rice variety or a wheat variety in the field itself, allow farmers to continue cultivating it year after year, there are likely to be changes due to either mutation or some other natural process in that variety, and some traits may actually be irreversibly lost in those varieties if you actually allow them to survive in the farmer's field itself. Historically, many such traits have actually been lost because farmers have cultivated and occasional crossbreeding happens and things change in the genetic structure. So it is important to store them in a pristine form in gene banks so that those traits are preserved, number one. Number two is that when there is a natural disaster, a flood or a war or something else of that sort, many of these varieties are irreversibly lost. They cannot be retrieved in a later time. So you can actually go to the gene bank, collect copies of the germplasm and restart cultivating the traditional varieties in those countries. That's exactly what the gene bank achieved. Even prior to Swaminathan's joining the IRI, for example, when Agent Orange was sort of put across regions of Vietnam by the Americans, many Vietnamese rice varieties were lost in the 1950s and 60s, which were again retrieved after the Vietnam War from the gene bank of IRI in Manila. When Swaminathan became the Director General in the Cambodian War of 1970s had just ended, Cambodia was limping back to normalcy. And what happened at that point of time was in 1986, there was a request from the Cambodian government as to whether they could have copies of their traditional varieties from the gene bank. And Swaminathan sent a team to Cambodia, and he sent with them all the varieties that Cambodia wanted from the gene bank. And thus, all these traditional varieties could be cultivated once again in Cambodia. And that's something that's a remarkable achievement of science in the preservation of traditional varieties and traditional knowledge. And Swaminathan was instrumental in this case as the Director General of IRI.
Right. And just one last question about like current scenario in agriculture. We all on one side talk about environmental conservation and cutting down on forests, and the other side expanding agriculture. Where do you think there is a fine line between both? Like what is your opinion about that?
You know, it would be wrong in my view to create some kind of a dichotomy or a binary discussion around technology and environment. I think the best way to protect environment is to use better technologies, is to use in more intensive technologies. For example, Green Revolution. Green Revolution, that is agricultural intensification through Green Revolution, has been extraordinarily friendly to the environment because India is supposed to have saved 30 to 40 million hectares of forest land from devastation thanks to the increase in productivity. If productivity had not increased, India would have had to cut down forests and cultivate rice and wheat or other traditional crops in the cut down forest land or fragile lands. So Green Revolution was enormously environmentally sustainable a measure because it saved forests from being cut down. On the other hand, there is this argument that more chemicals are used and which should increasingly come down. And agricultural scientists completely agree with that viewpoint. Agricultural scientists think that application of external fertilizers and chemicals like pesticides are essential at this point of time. But what we should aim for is to look for example, better chemistry. Can you have better molecules in these chemicals whereby you don't need to apply them in the quantities that you're applying them today? Can actually a lower quantity be applied in the future? And yet the impacts could be the same. Their effects could be the same. So that way you could reduce application of of chemicals in agriculture. Second, can you use drip irrigation, sprinkler irrigation, fertigation, nanotechnology, etc., whereby, again, you use chemicals as much as is required, but you are able to reduce the total amount that you need to apply because their use is much more efficient on the ground. So you don't need to apply them in that many quantities as you used to do in the past. So these are important innovations and advancements taking place in agricultural science, in chemistry and so on, which is certainly going to benefit science, benefit the environment in the future. Also important is to cite the important role that genetic engineering is likely to play. Genetic modification, gene editing, these are all extraordinary advances that are taking place in agricultural science, which are going to help us not apply fertilizers and other chemicals in agriculture in the future. If that happens, that would be yet another turning point in the use of science to save the environment. That I hope that will happen in the near future if the right amount of policy support is provided to these new technologies, just as India did during the Green Revolution period.
Okay, just one last question I'm taking from what you said now. We're talking about agroforestry, right? Because, of course, land use change and other things, right? So how do we preserve the forest and how do we have the agricultural land and how do we integrate it or how do we have demarcated sort of lines between them? Where do you think agroforestry is right now in India and in the world? And where do you think food security and, these different practices and environmental degradation, where do all of these fall? It's very confusing, right? And it's like, it's all linked to each other. So I just want some perspective on that.
No, see, agroforestry has been with us for a long period of time. And it is a truism that planting more trees, having more tree cover, helps you to preserve carbon and not emitting them into the atmosphere. That's certainly true. But the form of agroforestry has changed over a period of time. Earlier, the agroforestry programs of India focused on all kinds of trees, like, for example, eucalyptus and acacia and so on, where essentially you ended up planting trees which were hugely water absorbing in their growth. That is now being corrected. Agroforestry is continuing as a thrust area, but the kind of trees that you plant as part of agroforestry initiatives is slowly changing. You are trying to now look at trees which are less water absorbing and which have more canopy in terms of preserving carbon and so on, those which help more in sequestration of carbon. That's something that's a shift that is taking place within agroforestry to begin with. But more importantly, I'll also try to point out some advancements in science there. For example, even in agroforestry, the agricultural science has over a period of time developed crops or trees which are genetically modified, which have faster growth, which have thicker stems and so on, which are very important. For example, China. China uses a tree called poplar in its agroforestry initiatives. More recently, they have introduced GM poplar, a genetically modified poplar, which grows fast, has much better canopy, and helps to preserve much more carbon than in the past. So that those are initiatives happening in agroforestry as well vis-a-vis science. So we need to look at new ways of doing agroforestry. We need to use science in agroforestry, and certainly we need to ensure that's a shift that takes place in harmony with agricultural production. It's not a good idea to pose agroforestry as a counter or a substitute or as an opposite of agricultural production. You basically need to harmonize the two to ensure that the food security needs of the population are met, even as you ensure the conservation of environment and sustainability in production. Thank you.